Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris Effects. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 10 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to episode 15 of season 10. I've been using Boris Effects products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking with one of the Ace Eddie winning editors of Escaping Twin Flames, which won the Ace Eddie for Best Edited Documentary Non-Theatrical. Inbal Lesner, ACE, was the executive producer and supervising editor. We last spoke with Inbal for Seduced, Inside the Nexium Cult, Exposed, which was nominated for an Ace Eddie in 2021. Her other work includes the documentaries Brave Miss World, episodes of CNN's series of decade-defining documentaries, for which she was nominated for an Ace Eddie. In addition to her documentary work, she was also an additional editor on Natalie Portman's directorial debut, A Tale of Love and Darkness. Before I hop into our discussion with Inbal, a brief thank you to our partner, Boris Effects. I've been using Boris Effects and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris Effects is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris Effects suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, trailers, clips, timeline, screenshots, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And you can even go over there and read along as you listen to this podcast. And now, Inbal Lesner, ACE, discusses editing the Ace Eddie winning documentary series, Escaping Twin Flames. Inbal, it's so nice to talk to you again on another documentary series. Congratulations on the success of this one.
Thank you so much. I actually listened to our last podcast. I was like, okay, what else can I say?
I've interviewed Joe Walker 7 times, so.
I heard the last one. That was a fun convo.
Yeah, thank you. We should point out also that you are a producer or executive producer, both one, the other, of this in addition to editing.
So I co-created this series with my partner producer, Cecilia Peck. We pitched it and Netflix commissioned it. And I am an executive producer and an editor on the series.
Tell me how you structured the whole series. How was it determined how many episodes there would be and where each episode would end?
So Cecilia and I did the series Seduced Inside the Nexium Cult that came out 3 years ago on Stars. And this was our template. I mean, that show worked in terms of shedding light and also educating and exposing the story behind the Nexium Cult, but also from the point of view of the survivors and following their recovery and their process to reclaim their lives. And it was a pretty good template for us as we approached this story. Our idea was to make a 4-part series again. And unfortunately, Netflix were very adamant that it had to be 3. They just felt the story could be told that tightly in 3 parts. And I guess there's algorithm. 3 is the new 8, as they say in docuseries world.
Oh no, is that true?
There's been a recent, I guess, trend to tell these stories in a more economical way. Long gone is the trend of 8, 10, 12 part docuseries. Just seems to be very rare now. And so we had to figure out how to really take 4 hours of story and content. We really thought we had enough for 5, but kind of squeeze it into 3. And the first episode follows mostly the recruitment and allure of the group. You know, how these women found Twin Flames Universe by searching to solve their, you know, relationship issues or looking for love that was more deep and genuine, sort of beyond your typical dating app. We're really looking for a community and for a way to understand what is the type of deep romantic love they're looking for. And so how they stumbled upon this group, this couple that runs Twin Film Universe, what was appealing to them at first, what were the positive aspects of the group, and then slowly exposed the insidious indoctrination and how they got sucked into paying more and following the group and volunteering their time and working for the group. And so how they get sucked into that dynamic. The second episode goes more in depth about the indoctrination and the different programs, how they were under control in very different ways. There was financial control. There was control of their daily lives. There was even food control with this meal program, Divine Dish, and then thought control. Jeff, the leader, even proclaimed he was a religious figure. He compared himself to Jesus Christ. And so he was their second coming. Slowly, this group is taking over every aspect of their members' lives. And that's when we sort of expose their sexuality and gender agenda. By the third episode, you really see how the manipulation of gender and what happened in the group was divine pairings. So Jeff, who's now a religious leader, is channeling the word of God, I guess, and telling the members who they should partner with in order to be in harmonious union, they called it. So those manufactured couples now have to be together, sometimes move across state lines or international lines to be with each other.
Or gender lines.
Yep. Encouraged to change their sexuality, their gender identity, more than encouraged, coerced, I think. And we try to follow those members and their family members of some who are still in the group and trapped, and what the family members are doing and how they're taking action. And then at the end, you see the women who were brave enough to leave, how they are reclaiming their lives and coming together to tell the story in order to alert the authorities.
Talk to me about, from an editor's standpoint, some of the lovely moments, the pacing moments that weren't purely dialogue. Obviously, you have a huge amount of story. As you said, you thought you had 5 hours of story to tell. So how do you reduce that to 3 hours? How do you then also leave time for breath and moments of emotion and contemplation?
Obviously, our first pass when you tackle writing really a documentary like this, we first build the radio cut, and our sit-down interviews are the spine of the narrative. When we build them, we already try to give it some shape in terms of rhythm. So you don't want them to be all bunched up against each other. You really want, especially when the story is so outrageous, you want things to have time to land and for people to process. And there's also a lot of imagery because it's an online cult. These people never, actually other than 3 meetups that we show in the series, all the activity takes place online. And so a lot of our visuals are their Facebook group and Facebook posts and Instagram posts and emails and text messages. And there's so much text on the screen that you also need time to really read it and contemplate it and sit with it. And so it can't be sort of wall-to-wall dialogue. You have to have time for audience to understand, oh, this is something I need to read and I need to sit with it. So it was very careful crafting of the balance between the spoken word and music and some visuals to build tone. And then all the information we were showing on screen and how much of it one can even take. Thank you for saying that. It is a particular passion of mine to figure out the rhythmic landscape of the show and to make sure there's enough breath for people to connect and not just be assaulted verbally. They can understand it intellectually, but then we really want them to connect emotionally with the characters and understand what they're going through and how the barrage of the word salad of the leaders is really impacting them.
It's such an emotional story, and there's crazy moments where you're like, you know, how are these people processing this and thinking about it? And as an audience member, you've got to have a moment that allows you to just think about what you just heard. And I felt like I had that. So I definitely wanted to talk about it. What drove you in your interviews of when to cover the interview and when to see the interview on camera?
This is a good opportunity to explain that while I'm the executive producer and showrunner in charge of Post, not the sole editor, we had an amazing team editing on this show: Kevin Hebert, Mimi Wilcox, and Martin Bean. And then Troy Takaki, ACE, joined us at the end for Picture Lock. And I was supporting and helping to edit, and then also sort of stepped in with the very end to do some cutting myself. And the way we approached it was not siloed episodes, meaning this was a team that together was making a 3-hour film. And so I actually divided the work to every editor in being in charge on one character arc. So Kevin had the Keely arc, who's our main protagonist. And then he also handled Marley, her little sister. So that storyline of Keely and her little sister Marley and their journey from beginning to end, how they found a group, how Keely was promoted to be the CEO and was an enforcer as well. So this interesting dynamic of being abused, but also an abuser, which is a typical dynamic in cults. And we were so lucky that she was brave enough and open enough to share all that with us. I thought that was incredibly special that we were able to tell the depth and the complexity of her role in that story. Mimi Wilcox was in charge of the L storyline, the young woman who was pushed to engage in stalking, even went to jail, and then comes out and finally leaves the group and becomes enemy number one of Twin Flames universe. Then Martin Bean cut the Angie storyline. And then I helped cut the Paula and Louise, the sort of mother, twin sister, family members story. And then we intertwined them all together. And only after that, when we try to scramble all the scene and figure out the right order on a mirror board, then we said, okay, Kevin will be in charge of episode one, and then Mimi will take two, and Martin will take three. But we always worked as a team, and it was important to have editors who are really good collaborators, that they don't get precious about a certain scene or a certain splice. And they're all actually feeling inspired by the collaboration. And that if episode one was out to the network to get notes, Kevin would jump in and help with episode two or episode three or wherever we needed him. So we were able to kind of all jump around and be very involved with the entire series. And that really was the only way to get it done in that short time span.
It's very interesting how you broke up the storylines and then broke up the assignments of the individual episodes. One of the things that I'm really interested in is that idea of when do you cover a on-camera interview and when do you decide to put the on-camera interview on camera?
We're definitely looking for a certain emotional feeling, a delivery of a line that feels genuine, unrehearsed, a twitch in somebody's facial muscle, the way they blink their eyes in that moment, or sometimes it's actually right after you ask the question and you see their eyes sort of rolling and their brain turning to try to find the answer or to try to like capture that memory, because they go back, you actually see it in their faces as they go back and try to relive that moment or go back in their memories. It's interesting, some interviews we cover completely other than maybe the button of it or the beginning of it. I mean, you always want to make sure you connect the voice to a person and that you remember who those are. And we have multiple characters, so that was a challenge. How many of them do we introduce and when can we track each one and still have a connection to each one, even though there's multiple people to kind of get to know and care about? And so I think you always want to know who's talking to you, at least in our show. You want to know where the voice is coming from, identify it, see the face, really understand it. But then you want to be in their world. You want to see what they're seeing. You want to feel what they're feeling. And for that, you really need those images from their online world, from their meetups, from all these evidence that we gathered for 2 years before we even started the production. It's interesting. I mean, I remember when Cecilia filmed the main interview with Keely in her mobile home. I was monitoring it via Zoom, and I was completely glued to the screen, and I knew we had something really, really special. I just knew this was a moment. There's nothing like this on television, and I'm interested, and I want to watch this woman's face as she's telling this story. There are moments where she's not connected to herself. She's just remembering it, and because it's so traumatic, she has to have a barrier from her emotions to the facts. And I think you can read that on her face. And then the few moments where she's really is connected and feeling it, obviously those jumped at us. And you see in episode 3, when she's finally able to talk about her role in some of the abuse that was happening and how the cult leaders used her to abuse other members who were below her in terms of ranking. And I think reckoning with her role in the abuse and how she was able to get there and really believe that it was necessary and in the member's best interest, and seeing how she was able to finally wake up and recover from that is a fascinating human psychological thriller, I think. And so whenever that reflects on her face or anybody, especially those moments of like when they woke up, it's really fascinating to sort of watch their face and eyes and facial muscles as they recount those stories.
You could really see on Keely's face when she owned it, how painful it was for her to accept her part in that.
Yeah, but the series had to go there. We felt it was our duty as filmmakers, storytellers, journalists to make that part of the story, to not gloss over it, to say, yeah, she was part of this manipulation and abuse. But much like India Oxenberg in Nexium, that's because there was a hierarchy of command, and Keely was being used as a tool by the cult leaders, and things they dirty work that they didn't want to do themselves, or the way to remove themselves from legal responsibility. This is how most high control groups and cults work. And it was important to expose that and to allow her the ability to own up to it, but also to make amends. She meets with Angie in the last episode in a very, very emotional scene where she has the opportunity to apologize in person, and they kind of unpack together how they felt when they were inside the group and what's lingering after that. It was brave for Cecilia, our pack, our director, to confront that and go there with Keely and everything that means in terms of offering mental health support and really understanding what that means to ask a subject to confront those very difficult feelings. And our entire editing team, more than excellent editors, they're incredible humanitarians. They're just good humans. And they took very seriously that responsibility that was in their hands and the trust that the former cult members put in us to tell their stories respectfully, with dignity, with accuracy, and with compassion. And so all of our editorial arguments and conversations were around that. How do we tell this with the most ethical consideration and compassion for the former members and the family members that agreed to expose themselves in this series?
Yeah, one of the emotional moments that I thought was so incredibly revealing and painful was when Marley and Josh are on stage in episode 2. Marley looks so sad. You can tell by her eyes. She doesn't want to make eye contact. It was brutal.
I think it was important to us to say this is not just some bizarre group with eccentric rituals for your at-home pleasure and entertainment. This is criminal. So we took this very seriously. Every single screenshot, text message, piece of video has been vetted by multiple teams of lawyers, and it's all true to the original evidence. Obviously, sometimes we highlight a certain part of a text or we do some graphic treatments to make it TV friendly in terms of how it's seen on screen. But everything is the absolute truth and we couldn't take it lightly. There's humor, don't get me wrong. There's humor, there's lightness in the storytelling, and humor is really important when you tell dark, difficult stories, I think. I always insist on lacing my shows and films with as much humor as I can. But the crimes are serious and the abuse is super serious. And when you see Marley and Josh on stage in the Toronto meetup and Jeff is telling her, you know, how happy are you? Oh, I'm so happy. And you see in her face that she's feeling the exact opposite of what she's saying. And it's so telling. Like, there's a soundbite from her that reveals even more of what she was feeling behind the scenes, but you see it all in her face and it's heartbreaking. You know that she was pushed to move across state lines to Utah, where she's never been, to partner with a man she didn't know who was 11 years older than her, who had a criminal history, was on probation at the time, and had a mental health history. There was a lot of abuse while she was there in Utah living with him. And if this is not a clear case of sex trafficking, I don't know what is. It was obviously done so that the leaders could then publicize Marley and Josh as being a success story for their organization and help sell more subscriptions. And so they had a financial gain from this marketing trick, and it's all on the expense of 19-year-old Marley. And it's really a troubling story. It took us a while to gain her trust. We didn't have her participation. She wasn't in the series in the beginning. And finally, she sort of decided that it was worthwhile and that she was going to tell her story on her terms with the right support, but that she was going to participate. And so we added that story and the series got even longer. So it was even a bigger challenge to cut it back down to 3 hours. But I find her to be the heart of the story. And she's so expressive. You see her in the first meetup in Brooklyn and the second meetup in Toronto. Always when she comes on the screen, she has this beautiful, magical aura about her and so much pain underneath.
Yeah, there's evidence of innocence lost for sure. Some of this was really hard to watch. How do you edit things that are really hard to watch and protect yourself from the psychological impact of that?
Thank you for asking this question. Over the years, people ask me a lot because if you look at my IMDb, you see that the last 20 plus years, almost all I've done is documentaries about Holocaust and genocide and war and sexual assault and cults and racism and sexism and, you know, all those not very happy topics. I guess it's my niche. Dark is my niche. And I developed a coping mechanism. I really am able to compartmentalize the storytelling from the trauma. I know there's an impact. I know there's a price I'm paying personally, but at work, I really try to break it down to the story elements. Okay, this is the A story, the B story, the C story. This is the conflict. This is the resolution. This is the tension. What is the purpose of this scene? I don't want to say clinical, but I do get clear cut about what the story has to do. And then once that's built and I watch either what my editors do or a string out or the final episodes, when I sit back and watch, that's when I allow my body to feel it. And then I register where it's hitting me, in my gut or in my ribs or in my throat or in my skin, or how am I processing this emotionally? And then I have to sit and translate it back into the work, into the editing notes. But, you know, I go to therapy to talk about. Physical exercise is super great to get some of that out. I started kickboxing recently. Any kind of a walk when you're feeling overwhelmed or even just in need of a new editorial idea, that seems to help. I try to separate my home, family life, personal life from my work life as much as I can. It's not always easy, especially when you're also the executive producer and it's not like a 9 to 6 or 9 to 7 or 9 to 5. It's more involved than that. More than anything, feel a sense of mission and a sense of responsibility to tell these stories. It's more than a job, it's a calling. The more you do these type of films and shows, and you see the impact of those stories in the world, and you hear from people who watched these stories and it impacted them and it changed them in some way, or they learned something, it really invigorates you to do more. And so I keep seeing that when I have difficult days or difficult moments on the project, I kind of can close my eyes and imagine the end goal, and that, okay, this will be out in the world and we'll do what it needs to do. And I just have to like go through this pain to get there. And of course, while protecting myself, and I'm so glad this conversation has become more acceptable and prevalent in the documentary community, and that it's more standard operating procedure to offer mental health support, not just for the true crime victims on the screen, the survivors on the screen, but also for the production staff and post-production staff. It's not easy because it's secondhand trauma that's with a long exposure. So it's not just something terrible that happened to you and then you tell the story. Most of us as documentary editors are empaths, and we're like trying to feel it and put ourselves in the shoes of the people whose stories we tell, and to go through that emotional empathy day in and day out and hear their stories again and again for either 4 months or 6 months or 3 years. It's a lot of pain you're processing. And so it's good to be able to talk about it more and to come up with industry standards for it. Because I've been in situations where that wasn't the case. And people didn't understand why they're having nightmares or are compelled to like reach to their phone to play a mindless game in the middle of the workday. Like, why is this happening to me? Like, well, because you're dealing with trauma on the screen for 10 hours a day. It's not easy, and it's okay to talk about it and figure out together how we can support people who do that work.
You're part of a documentary group that advocates for that, correct?
I think maybe we talked about it last time I was on your show. I'm actually not as involved now as I have been a few years ago. But at some point, I was on a mental health committee for the ADE. And we tried to increase the awareness and offer different methods of support for people working in documentary editing when they're facing difficult subject matters or just the way the work impacts their personal lives. And so I think, like I said, there's much more awareness now than there's been in past years. What was easy for me to answer, I think 10, 20 years ago, is not as easy today. I'm now working on a film about very recent traumatic events, and it's not as easy for me as some of the other, or I should say it's even more difficult than other films. So 20 years of experience doing this may have just worn me thin to the point where I can't do this anymore. Time will tell. You think you develop a hard shell, but sometimes it just, maybe your heart gets actually thinner.
There's several illustrated, graphical, animated moments throughout the film. How did you determine that you needed those? And then what did you do while you were waiting for them to be animated and the graphics to be done? Did you just use scene cards, or what did you do?
So Cecilia and I started using this animated recreations in Seduced, and we knew we didn't want to film sort of typical recreations for this show as well, and that we wanted this animated treatment, but we also wanted to try something a little different. And there were some stories that we didn't have footage for. We didn't have photos or video clips, and we knew there were cornerstones of the narrative that we couldn't do it without, and it wasn't strong enough for the interviewee to just be on screen. And I'm sure you know, Steve, but the way people talk is not the way we necessarily want to edit them on screen, where they sound coherent and clear and they say all the right words in the right order. So, you know, sometimes you have to help them a little bit to make sure the story makes sense and flows and has good rhythm. And so it's not like we could just put them on camera for a minute to tell the whole story without any visual support. And so those are the moments we chose to animate. And we worked with an amazing artist, Yakfu Animation, two artists. They're a New Zealand, Australia-based company. And so the time difference was a real challenge. But they came up in the development phase with some ideas for looks and styles. And I told the editors, whenever we have a story we don't have the material for, go wild. Just put whatever comes to mind on a slate. Don't just put a slate that says animation to come. Try to imagine with us, what could that look like? What would you like to see here? And so we would talk about these things, and we would change those slates probably 50 times. We would come with that idea. We would do the export of that clip and show it to the animation company, and they would bring maybe something even more unexpected. Because what you can do with animation, you can't do with live action footage. You can be nuanced. You can be allegorical, right? You can have suggestive and abstract visual ideas, sort of like a abstract painting. And so that's how we wanted them to have the magic of the beginning, the love stories we knew in episode one and beginning of episode two, everybody sort of recounting their love stories and their quote unquote twin flame stories. Those would always be animated, and there'll be some magic to it where you felt the warmth and the allure. And then if you notice, the color palette starts changing. And as you go on with the series and it becomes colder and bluer, and the online world is always sort of cold and distant. When we talk about the map program, which was a very dangerous mind alignment process, sort of psychological manipulation tool of the group, we use the animation in a very creative way to show how they insert a certain bad memory or the possibility of a bad memory that wasn't there before, but somehow it colors the whole perspective of somebody going through this almost hypnosis-like ritual and everything that comes out of the other. So it shows like a wave going into her head, and then something gets colored darker, and then the wave coming out of the other side of her head is now dark, and the stain is growing, the dark stain. And so it was really fun to find those visual manifestation of the indoctrination and of the abuse. How do we tell that in a visually interesting way that couldn't be really done in any other way but animation? And, you know, we love those segments. They're only, I think, two or three minutes of that in the whole series, but they really stand out. We really wanted people to be like perk up or sit up in their couches when they get to those segments.
It really feels like much more than 2 or 3 minutes. If you'd asked me to guess, I would have tripled that number or something. What kind of writing was there, apart from the editing itself? Or was the writing synonymous with the editing?
I think the writing is always synonymous with documentary editing, and I wish it was a standard procedure to give all documentary editors a writing credit.
That's Walter Murch's absolute belief.
I'm totally with Walter on this. It's interesting. He said in your last interview with him that in fiction we have, and I'm butchering his actual quote, we have few events, but a lot of coverage. And in documentary, you have a lot of events, but no coverage. And so, you know, that's definitely right in this, and as well as all the other documentaries I've done. But you're working with a lot of events, a lot of information, and distilling it down to a narrative that makes sense, that goes from A to B to C, that somebody can track and follow intellectually and emotionally. There's writing every second. It's not writing something out of nothing, but it's writing something out of something. So it's taking every character interview and finding the core beats that make up their story, finding a way to write it all into one integrated story when you interlace all these characters together. In terms of actual writing, meaning putting pen to paper, we had to write a full scene-by-scene outline before we shot anything, and that got submitted to Netflix for approval as they commissioned the series. Cecilia likes to be very prepared for interviews, so we write all the questions. We help her write all the questions. Sometimes we imagine what the answer would be, but we don't dictate it. We're often surprised and integrate new information that comes up in interviews into the story, because people remember new things once they sit in front of the camera or they reframe it a certain way. So we leave a lot of room for discovery in the interviews, but we definitely write a lot of questions going into it. And Cecilia does an amazing job prepping and then also allowing herself to be really present and respond to the story as it's unfolding. And then every time we had a rough cut or cut done, we would transcribe it, distribute that document. And then my father actually tragically passed away while we were editing. And so on the plane, you know, I took a, at that point, it was a 3-hour episode 3 cut, and I just on paper slashed it down to an hour and a half, I think, and then to an hour. So the writing can be done even outside of the editing room in terms of reshaping, distilling, cutting down. And then a lot of writing is being done on the storyboard level just by changing the order and deciding what storyline is going to be introduced at what point of the story. You know, that's definitely a lot of writing decisions.
You mentioned that great Walter Murch quote about documentary having lots of scenes, but very little coverage. I was thinking of one great moment where the mom gets a text message from her child in the middle of the interview, and how you're trying to stretch that moment out. You're trying to have it have as much impact as you can. And yet I'm sure, you know, you're filming it with one or two cameras and there's only so much you can do. Can you talk about building a moment like that mom getting that text message from her child?
The bigger context is that family alienation is something in common with all high control groups that we've seen and followed and studied. And it's really, really heartbreaking element of the manipulation. Because once you cut somebody off their family and their loved ones and the people that can offer them other points of view about what's happening to them, then they're completely malleable and susceptible to undue influence. Cecilia and I really care about the stories and wanted to do it justice. And this mom who was introduced in episode 3, Debbie, she talks about falling out of touch with her child, that she'd been trying to reconnect with her child and sent him a text message. And we go somewhere else. And when we come back to her, she's talking about something else. And this really happened in real time. Cecilia, when she was talking about sending the text message, Cecilia said, well, why don't you just send it now? And she did. And as they went along and talked about something else, all of a sudden the phone vibrates and she looks at it. She goes, ah, I got a text back. And so figuring out how to use the dailies to make you feel that you're there and it's happening in real time. And even though there's two cameras rolling and, you know, it's obviously a set with lights and crew in our home, we're not a fly on the wall, but within that context of a sit down interview, this was spontaneous, genuine moment. They kept rolling and she read it and we take our time to show it. We strip down the music. There's nothing there except that. And then slowly the music comes back in and we shot a pickup from afterwards of her over the shoulder, showing the close-up of the screen. So that allowed us another angle in addition to the two cameras that were the wide and the close that were on her frontal. So we had that insert. We just kind of let it play. And then the most debate was about the moment that follows. At the end of our interview, she gets up and spontaneously she got a hug from the two other moms that were there. Because she really broke down reading the text. She had not heard from her child in so long. And to get that text was so emotional for her that when she got up, she was just sobbing and the other moms were so moved because they're also cut off from their children and they wanted to offer her support and commend her bravery. There's a lot of things happening behind the scenes you're not even aware of as you're watching the show, but it's all very human and complicated. And so they had this moment of embrace. For a while, we debated how much of it and whether it's even that it even belongs in the show. And I think we went through a few versions of it, and I love how where we ended with it. You get to experience her struggle with the loss of contact with her child and the possibility that she could get in touch again. And we actually had another scene that got left on the cutting room floor, but that mom goes to Dr. Adair, our transgender expert, and she asks Dr. Adair how to approach her child now and how does she deal with even the pronouns and what can she say, because in her heart she believes the transition was under coercion, but her child is identifying is now a male, is a transgender male, and Dr. Adair tells her you have to meet your child where they're at, that's who they are now, and you have to accept it for any communication to even to begin. We really loved the scene, and I think Netflix felt it was a little too broccoli. They have this idea of like their viewers like chocolate-covered broccoli. So if you're going to educate somebody, you need to do it with
a little sugar, a little honey.
Yes, a little spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down.
That's literally my next question, which was scenes that got dropped to the cutting room floor late in the process. And any scenes that dropped out and came back, why did they get dropped out and why did they come back?
When you work on developing a show like this for 2 years, like Cecilia and I have, along with Morgan Poffrell, our supervising producer, and then you go through the year of filming and cutting, you're so in the story that we were trying to remain open to notes, right? We're trying to remain open to our very, very talented executives at Netflix. And if they told us to cut something, Cecilia would say, no, we can't cut that. I would say, well, let's try it. I was always open to try it. I also knew there wasn't a lot of time to debate this back and forth. The only way you can know for sure is to just try it. There's a lot of things we cut and then we were missing too much and said, okay, I understand why you wanted to cut it, but I think I can bring it back elsewhere, or I can bring it back in a new context. Any one of those sort of very taste scenes, definitely the interviews, they're so long, you can pick anything from it. But also anytime you see a scene of a conversation, let's say between Dr. Lalich and Keeley, which was on the chopping block for a while, we weren't sure we were going to get to keep it. But they met and spoke, because you can imagine, for a couple of hours. So you can play it 500 different ways, depending on what part of the conversation you choose to include. So in narrative, you have scenes that go away and come back, but it's rare that you can tell a scene 500 different ways. It is what it is. They didn't ad lib and roll for 2 hours to see what they get. They kind of know where the scene starts and ends. But in our case, if another editor took a crack at it, or we just went back to the transcript, the raw, we could really make a new scene that said something else, that started one way and ended up another way. So that Keeley Dr. Lalich scene with Yanya Lalich, the cult expert, at the end of episode 3, that is again a scene that went through many iterations. I really loved coming into it from Keeley finding her own voice and starting to speak publicly on TikTok against the group. I was told to cut it so many times that I knew unless I nail it really quickly, I'm not going to get to keep it. So in 10 seconds, I had to establish that Keeley's speaking out on TikTok. Yanya, which was really the truth, Yanya paid attention or somehow noticed it and contacted her, Dr. Lalich. Sorry, I keep calling her different things, but it's Dr. Yanya Lalich. So she notices her TikToks, she approaches her. So we had to show this kind of text exchange, Instagram text exchange. And then Keeley writes her back and then they meet. And so you kind of had to distill all these months of Keeley being outspoken and their conversations, multiple conversations between them. And then finally Keeley coming to meet Diana for the first time in person and gets to understand and forgive herself for her role as a deployable agent that the cult leaders used in order to abuse other members. All that had to somehow be communicated in 2 minutes. And I think that was a big challenge. And that little transition, I'm very proud of, that TikTok to the text message to her coming up the stairs, you just understand that these two women are going to have a meeting of the minds that's going to be very emotionally impactful and kind of set Keeley on a new trajectory of making amends and reconciling with herself.
Amazing. Months of true story boiled down to seconds on screen to tell the same emotional part of the story.
Yes.
Imbal, I could talk to you about this forever. I love chatting with you about documentary. Thank you so much for joining us. You also have another documentary that's out now, correct?
Yes. Along with my partner editor, Ben Kaplan, I edited Stormy, about one and only Stormy Daniels. And that's out on Peacock. Came out a couple of weeks ago and very, very proud of it. Has gotten some good attention as Trump is getting ready to face Stormy in court.
Inbal, thank you so much for your time. I hope we get a chance to chat for that secret project you alluded to earlier in the interview.
I hope so too.
That's it for Out of the Cup this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support, clips, and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Inbal Lesner, ACE, for discussing her work on Netflix's Ace Eddie-winning documentary series, Escaping Twin Flames. Thanks also to our partner, BorisFX. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com. I'm Steve Holfish, ACE. Thank you for listening, and please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you want a good follow on socials, I'm on Twitter and Instagram as @SteveHolfish.